Hello 90s footy fans, welcome to episode 79 of the 90s Club Footy Podcast. This week our guest is former AFL Club CEO Cameron Schwab. Cameron is one of Australia's well-known sporting administrators. During his long reign in the AFL, he worked for three AFL clubs, Richmond, Melbourne and the Fremantle Dockers, with the Tigers giving him his first opportunity as CEO at the age of 24. In this episode, Cameron talks about his initial days working in recruitment at Melbourne, taking on the CEO role with Richmond, the SOS campaign to save the Tigers, some of the hard decisions he had to make, working with the Fremantle Dockers, and the influence his late father Alan had on his career. I hope you enjoyed the 79th member of the 90s Club Footy Podcast, Cameron Schwab.
Cameron Schwab, thank you for joining me on the 90s Club Footy Podcast. An absolute pleasure to have you on and reflect on your footy journey during that great time or great decade.
Yeah, no, it was very forming for me as we were talking about. You know, I was young coming into it, I suppose, and so the 90s also coincided with some pretty big things in life, to be honest. You know, not just in regard to obviously the game, which was going through an enormous amount of change during that period of time, although we could pretty much pick any decade and we could think of it as a time of change. The game doesn't stand still, that's for sure.
It keeps on evolving, doesn't it? Hey, it's been a few years now since you're on the AFL scene. What are you doing with yourself currently, and do you still have any direct footy involvement?
Yeah, I do. The core of my work now is actually I teach leadership for a living. Am I allowed to swear? Am I allowed to do that?
Absolutely, you can.
Well, don't teach anything I haven't fucked up is one of the things I say. So, because I got to do the CEO thing for a very long time. So I was almost 25 years as a club CEO. So it was basically it definitely draws on the elements of high performance as it relates to sport, but also recognizing that whilst I'm a football person by background, I was a CEO and had to run, and that balance between profit model and business performance and team performance, all of the elements of that was the space that I had to try and operate in. There's a lot of ambiguity and paradox in those two areas. So basically teach that, and really in many ways, one of the things leaders have to be good at is good at those very things: the ambiguity, the nuance, the complexity, the conflict. And well, the 90s had plenty of that thrown in. I know that. So I was learning those lessons from a leadership perspective, probably very much at the same time as I was growing up as well. So there was, so that's basically what I do now. My involvement in sport, I actually coach some leaders who are in the AFL scene. I coach, I'm sure you won't mind me mentioning it, but I've been working with Michael Voss, over the past year or so, just in regard to the leadership elements of sport. Not so much. None of the X's and O's, although we inevitably talk a bit about footy, obviously, but it's mostly just how people, deal with and particularly running a big club or being a coach of a big club such as Carlton. Which for a Richmond bloke, because I'm a Richmond background guy, every time I walk through the Carlton Footy Club, there's a couple of premiership cups, sitting on plinths that I feel like kicking over because there was Carlton were the I grew up with various enemies in life. One of them was the Joker from Batman and Lex Luthor from Superman, and the other one was Carlton. So that was sort of the enemies growing up. And here I am doing some work, and I got to say, he's fantastic to work with. He's one of the great. He's unbelievably humble guy, given his amazing achievements. But he's also a terrific learner. So he comes very prepared for whatever we talk about as it relates to what is clearly a very challenging role.
Fantastic, mate. Let's go back to your journey. Started back in the 80s as a recruiting manager with the Melbourne Football Club. How do you remember those days? What were some of the significant memories you had of that role?
Yeah, no, it was a wonderful time. I grew up with the game. I think that's probably the context to it, that because my father, Alan Schwab, was ended up being executive commissioner of the AFL, but he was probably best known as the secretary of the Richmond Football Club. And the secretary is the CEO, but just title inflation in many ways. But the core thing that a secretary was really in many ways was a recruiter back in the time. And so I grew up with a lot of the folklore stories of what recruiters did and how they went about their business. And I vividly remember my dad going on recruiting trips and coming back and telling me who he'd seen or the player wasn't as good as he thought he was going to be. And there's a couple of stories coming to mind. I remember because I'd wait for him to come home every night and he'd sit at the end of my bed and we'd have a chat. And I always say to people, it's the best 10 minutes of my day because I was a fanatic on the sport. And I had a line right through to the person who was in charge of the club that I'd fallen in. I'd fallen hopelessly in love with the Tigers. And I remember him going to Tassie once and I said, oh, can you come back with another Royce Hart? And he said, I'd love to. You only get one of them in a lifetime, he said. And it's really stayed with me, that idea. And then he said, oh, we signed this tall young gangly kid and I think he's going to be all right. And he said, he's going to come and stay with us. And he came and stayed with us. My little brother got kicked out of bed and he was actually sleeping in my room in the next bed. He's this 17, 18-year-old gangly kid, and it was Michael Roach was the and so I often remind Roachie of that story. I think he was way too big for the bed that we'd actually kept him in. And so I grew up with those things, and I remember him actually going to Mildura saying that I've come back, I'm going up to watch a champion centre half forward, and he got up there and the champion centre half forward was 5'5" and a half, he said, and he come back and he said, I don't think he's going to play centre half forward, but I think he might be all right, and that was Dale Waitman. So these are stories that I grew up with, and then what happened was, probably because of my surname Schwab, I just applied for a job in the paper as like an office boy at the Melbourne Footy Club. I was straight out of school and Ron Barassi's the coach. And I remember the executive director of the club, Dick Seddon, at the time when he was trying to explain my job, he just said, do whatever Ron Barassi asked you to do. It was pretty much what the job description was, and which might be the best job description I've ever had. So, how it came about was I was at team meetings and Barassi was coaching the team, and he'd have like a foolscap piece of paper with whatever pieces of coaching you want to show, whichever pieces of vision, but it was an unedited tape. So he was just rewinding fast forward to whatever places on it. And if the meeting went for 2 hours, about an hour and a half of it was Brass rewinding and fast forwarding. And I love music and always been into music. And a lot of people in my generation, perhaps your generation, remember this idea of the mixtape. He used to always make these mixtapes, tape to tape. And so I offered to edit Brass's tape. I approached him, he gave me his foolscap piece of paper, and I went to about 4 o'clock in the morning this day. I went to Tandy Electronics, picked up a cord, and I connected the video at home with a video from the footy club that I'd brought home with me, and I edited out his tape and took it back the next day, and he put it into the video recorder and he pressed play, and he looked at me like I was a freaky genius, that I'd done this thing. And he said, oh, can you do this every week? And I said, yeah, no worries. No, that it was going to take me till 4 o'clock in the morning to do it every week. And it actually ended up taking me longer because he ended up with more time in the team meetings. He could actually coach to 20 or 30 different pieces of footy just compared with the 8 or 9 or 10. And every so often I'd see something when I was doing the edits and I'd go, I reckon there was another time, you've been talking about this and we did that. And he'd go, I'll put it on the tape. He'd actually say, yeah, put it on the tape. And look, I'm only 18 or 19 at this time. And he had this straight away, this sort of respect, if you like, that there might be some view of it. And I think a lot of it went back to the way I'd grown up, that there were conversations around my house all the way through. Tommy Hafey would come over as coach of the Tigers and he would sit and talk with my dad and they'd talk about the games. And so I was probably almost through a process of osmosis, but also a deep interest in it. I reckon I'd become like a student of the game really early in my life, and it was almost the only thing I could see myself doing in lots of ways, although I never thought that it would ever happen because it just seemed such a big thing to do. And then a few years later, Brass said, have you ever thought about doing recruiting? And I hadn't really, because I thought that was for these really clever people. And he said, I think you got a bit of a feel for it. And so I started recruiting, and it wasn't long after, it was one of the earliest games. I actually drove to Adelaide to watch a game because we didn't have any money. And I watched the game. Sturt were playing Port Adelaide, I think it was, at Unley. And I saw this guy play, and he literally shrugged we won the ball and got tackled and shrugged. And the bloke, he shrugged the guy over his shoulder like it was a martial arts thing or something like that. And then just burst through, long kick. And I put a circle next to his name. And I went back and said, I think we're going to have to go for this player. I think he's exactly what we need. And Brass was prepared to back my judgment in on him, even though he had a really unfamiliar football background. He played tennis all the way through his junior career. It was Todd Viney was the player.
And yeah, right.
Todd ended up with a great career. And so Brass backed my judgment on those things, even at a very young age. And so we talk about how things happen and how it evolves for you, that was so circumstantial for me. And Brass had seen something in me that I never ever fathomed or thought was ever possible for me. And I've got to say, throughout my career, that's actually how it played out, that people often would see things in you that you'd never seen in yourself. And even in the work I'm doing now, coaching and teaching leadership, it was because people approached me about being coached and taught, not because I ever thought. And I've really loved it and really enjoyed it and find it a very good thing. So the recruiting thing went from that. And Brass had a huge impact on Melbourne, but we didn't have success during his era. And then John Northey came in as coach. He was a Richmond background guy. And so we hit it off really well. And then Melbourne made the finals in 1987 for the first time in 24 years. And it was a big moment. It was the year where Jimmy Steins ran over the mark and Robbie Flowers last year. And so it was a very storied period for Melbourne Footy Club. And I'd recruited a lot of the players who played that in that time. And I was the same age as the players too. I think that was actually I remember when I'd knock on their doors, they'd look at me because I was a really young looking person as well. And you know, I don't reckon I kicked in on puberty till I was about 17 or 18. And I was a really young looking guy. And they'd look at me and they'd go, when's the big guy coming? When's the big boss coming in, sort of stuff. But I could form really good relationships with the guys. And some of those, you know, guys like Todd and I, they've been lifelong friends ever since. And so we made the finals in 1987. So that was really tough. I learned the value of hard work during that period, no doubt, you know, that because you just, you know, it was getting in the car and driving up to, you know, country towns. And I remember having a mindset, no one's going to outwork me. That's probably a good thing to do for a period of your life, but certainly not sustainable in the long term. And it was very much modeled by the people who I worked with and around who were very, very desperate for success to a club which had historically been very successful but hadn't been for a long period of time. And even though I was a Richmond bloke, I certainly... the Melbourne Football Club really captured my heart and forever grateful for the opportunity I was given at that time.
The Jim Steins story, were you a part of that? Were you one of the major reasons that got Jim over to Australia and playing VFL football at that stage? Did you have a major hand in that one?
No, I didn't, but I was there. And when I say a major hand, it actually probably came from my father because they... The AFL were doing a fair bit of work and they took a schoolboys team over as well. And I remember coming back because there was a few years earlier, Brassy went with a team, they were called the Galahs, one of the best named sporting teams of all time. You know, the Galahs played games and Brassy played and Hassaman played. A lot of, good footy people played in that game. And there was always a thought that it could actually happen. And the year that I started at Melbourne was 1982. It was the year that Sean White actually arrived and played in our under-19s in that year and was a terrific player. And then it was, I reckon, 84 Jim came over. So I was established as recruiting, but I didn't go over and select him or anything like that. The person who did was Barry Richardson. We had a person in... I can remember his name, Brother Tom McDonald. His name was Brother Tom McDonald, was the person who would identify the talent. And we brought over Jimmy and another guy, James Fahey, at the time. And so I would go pick him up at the airport, find them their board and their lodgings. And I remember even having a kick with him out the front because the offices of the Melbourne Footy Club were just up the road from the MCG. So we'd have a kick in the car park over the road and Ray Jordan and these guys were teaching him how to kick. Mate, he couldn't make really much contact with the ball, but they showed him and I was never a good kick, but I reckon I was kicking it back over his head at that time. But you could tell straight away. And I remember we went for a run and they ran around the lake and he was so far in front, he actually stopped and waited for the other guys to catch up because he was worried that he'd got lost or something like that. So we're talking about a really big guy who had this unbelievable engine. It was just, you know, he obviously had his enormous heart. That was pretty obvious right from the start, and a great determination to do well. But he had just a huge amount of learnings to do. But in the very first year he came over, I reckon he came second in the best and fairest in the under 19s to a guy, Steve O'Dwyer. So we had the two ruckmen. Yep. And so the two ruckmen were 1-2. So that's a pretty bloody good effort, you know, good level junior footy to come, never played the game in your entire life. And then the next year we struggled, we had this glut of ruckmen, and we actually sent him out to Paran, and he played out at Paran. And that was during the 86 year, and he sort of really grew as a result of actually played against men. And then 87, he made his debut. And then I think it was only about his 10th or 11th game where he actually went over the mark. And, you know, probably want to, I still get a bit teary when I feel that one. You know, I then got to experience the highs and the lows of the game, certainly from that point onwards. But that was the most heartbreaking game that I'd ever been a part of. Yeah.
Yeah, I've spoken to Rod Grinter about this one at length, and he gave away
the free kick. Rodney gave away the bloody free kick.
Well, Ball said that he probably was lucky that the 50 happened, because he would have been the one that had all the acid put on him in the end.
He would have, yeah, because it's pretty good. Bucky could have a shot from outside 50 without any worries. Yeah. And because it's one of those story games, because Melbourne kicked with the win 3 times in that game. We actually kicked with the, and it was a decent sort of wind. And I reckon they had the wind in the last quarter, but I think we had it in, it sort of worked out that it swung around. I'm trying to work out which way it went. But Bucky was such a great kick, but it went through over post height. The interesting thing was we would have almost struggled to make a team the next week. We lost a lot of players with injury that day as well. And so everyone says, oh, it's the one that got away. But Carlton were a real good side. They ended up beating Hawthorn pretty easy in the 87 grand final. And we were really banged up. So Robbie Flower broke his collarbone that day. Brian Wilson broke down. A guy, Warren Dean, broke down. He was a terrific player. So I'm not sure if we would have. We literally would have been down to our last guys. There's a guy, Jeff Allardyce, who played cricket for Victoria, and I think he's now CEO of the ICC. He's done really well, and he was an emergency that day. And would have had to play in a grand final. Would have been his first game because we'd run out of players. We'd run out of players. So if Bucky, if the thing doesn't happen, Jeff Allardyce makes his debut in a grand final the very next week, and he never played AFL footy. So that's, you know, that's how we were down to our sort of right into the depth players at that point. Yeah.
1988, you became the youngest ever CEO of a VFL team, taking on the role at Richmond at age 24. Would have been an interesting one to get your hands on at that age, and I guess where the club's level of financial difficulties were occurring, and I guess their results on field weren't going all that well as well.
No, it's a very different one club to the one I'd grown up with. That was for sure. And it was, again, so that was someone identifying something in me that I had yet to see in myself. And because I went straight from school working footy, I'd never done any business courses, or I was probably starting to get my head around doing perhaps something one day, and I always assumed, even going into footy, that I'd probably go back to uni at some point in my life. But then my career built some momentum, and I'd never seen a balance sheet before in my entire life, and I thought they're interviewing me about being the CEO of a club which is everyone knows they're in enormous financial difficulty, and I go to an interview. I say, "Can I check that? When I come to the interview, can I see the balance sheet?" Yeah, no worries. They put it in front of me. I had no idea what I was looking at, like nothing at all. But I could tell by the furrowed brows of the people in the room around me that it was, and there's a lot of red on the paper, so I shouldn't have been very good. But I learned quick about all that sort of stuff. And so, yeah, the club was just a shadow of what it once was. And clearly I was very young. Hopefully this sounds all right, but I remember, because Dad would have known what's going on. He was executive commissioner of the AFL. And I'm sure that in recruiting me, they thought they were going to get a fair bit of Dad as well. That would have been part of it. And he was a life member, and he was at Richmond when they won three premierships, and probably in the 1980, he wasn't there, but probably they were most of the players he recruited brought in. And I remember saying to Dad, because they were on the bottom and broke, and he said, I'm not sure it's a very good job. And he said, look, I don't, please take this the right way. He said, because if it was a very good job, the chances are they wouldn't be asking you, is what he said. And there was no negativity in that at all. He was basically saying that, you know, they're not going to a 24-year-old. You know, they're backing you in on the basis of they believe you are the best available person for this job. And the core is this idea of best available. So even when people ask me, well, how does that happen? I say, well, in their opinion at the time, I was the best available person. If there was sort of the 1988 equivalent of a Brian Cook or whatever, well, they're not asking me for the job. And it's interesting because even since then, at different times where, you know, you have put your hand up for roles and you've been unsuccessful, I've then had this reflection that it's not because you couldn't do the job. It's because they think in terms of what they're looking for, there's someone better suited to that role. And so I took it on and just gave it everything. But clearly I was very young. But I'd had in one part of my life this unbelievably maturing experience. But, you know, I was still 24. Like we'd often get reminded by, you know, club psychologists when our players play up and do things that, okay, well, just so you know, the male brain doesn't kick in until it's 25 or 26, you know, and then it's some guys, it's still kicking in their mid-30s, and you and I, we both know blokes, they're still waiting for it to kick in. But, you know, and I was really, so my frontal cortex or whatever needs to have evolved and developed probably hasn't really at that stage. And I was dealing with, you know, enormous, you know, pressures and expectations and it was a really challenging, but I loved it, you know. And we did show some signs, and we did some stuff which were really quite game changing at the time. We did the SOS campaign, Save Our Skin campaign, which in many ways did exactly what we said it was going to do. It did save the club, you know. Would the club have survived anyway? Well, I'm not sure, you know. But it was so desperate and so hopeless. And what it did was it helped the bank balance, but it sort of rekindled the spirit as well. And also there was a generation of people who came through the club at that time who have had a really significant role in time. Like Brendan Gale played his first game in 1990, so my second year. And clearly was always a, you know, good young fella. And, you know, well, he's been as significant a figure in Richmond as, you know, Alan Schwab or Graham Richmond or any of those, you know. Percy Page, you know, all these great Richmond people in the history of the club. He's been as significant as any of them. And he probably, the depth of the experience that he had, good and bad, I've got no doubt, has informed him as one of the great administrators in the sport.
What sort of toll did the Save Our Skins campaign take on with you, I guess, with obviously the importance of the campaign and the importance of raising money, but also, as you said, to rekindle that spirit? Like, was that a fair bit of a toll it took on you to make sure that campaign succeeds?
Yeah, it did, but it didn't. Like, I doubt whether I've ever worked harder, but I think there's been times, because I've gone into clubs when there was a fair bit going on, you soon learn that there's an opportunity embedded in that. And so even within, it's probably the hardest is when you're sort of midstream, whereas clearly there's something has to give in those environments. And so you have to go from sort of crisis to controlling fairly quickly and then hopefully challenging. That's the sort of phases that I talk to often when clubs are in that. Even coming out of COVID, you think that we're in crisis. We need people to show some control. We rely on government, medical. And then eventually we come out of, we sort of start to challenge our thinking. Was that the right thing? Is that, you know, how do we do this better? And with a goal that you get to a place where you've got high levels of cohesion, we were going through all three of those things. And there's, you know, you're obviously tired. And so when you talk to people about when you're exhausted or you got that sense of it, what's the antidote to that? Well, yes, there's parts of it which is more rest and, you know, I need to spend more time, you know, renewing and take a holiday, those sorts of things. But I find being wholehearted in an endeavor with people who you really care about and for something which is way bigger than you, to be an unbelievably energizing thing to be a part of. And so I'm sure it was taking its toll, but it didn't feel like that. Yeah. I just was still pinching myself that I was doing what I was doing, I think, you know, and I still do now, you know, I still think that now. Like I look back on 25 years as though it was something out of the Truman Show or something like that, that you actually got to do this thing that, you know, that it's been the sort of narrative of my existence, if you like, and I still get to talk about it every day and the work I do. And during that period, you know, I'm sure if people, you know, they might have looked at me and said, "You look stuffed." You know, I'm sure there were those times, but I never felt it to be anything other than an energizing, wholehearted experience. There were certainly some difficult times. I was involved with Kevin Bartlett, and when we sacked him as coach, and that, no doubt, is a as something which, you know, as a reflection and all that, was, you know, obviously far more traumatic for Kevin than anyone, but in its own way, probably, you know, was one of the great learning experiences personally as well. I think I felt pretty bloody exhausted at the end of all of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess, you know, that would have been a tough time. You know, club legend Kevin Bartlett, even no matter what club it is, to make those big decisions. And as you said, you've got
back in your way. Yeah, no doubt. And I, you know, one of my childhood heroes as well. And I love working with him as well. So, you know, these are often decisions which are made in your best judgment, and that's all it is. And once you've made a call on something, you've made a decision on something, you know, you've got the title CEO for a reason. You know, you've got the title, you know, you're there on really as many things. If leadership's about anything, it's normally about really almost two things: which part of what we're doing now needs to endure, because that's an important part of who we are, and which part of us needs to change. And often, you know, whilst a lot of the focus is, you know, on the change piece, because there's more headline in that, you know, even the part of you which is enduring, you still have to improve and polish and make better. But when there's part of it, when you're absolutely convinced that part needs to change, well, that's what you signed up for. And so even in as a reflection, because I then had to deal with that myself, as in being on the other side of it, having that decision made for me, and it happened twice, both in Melbourne. The first time it happened, it was devastating, because I just felt that it was so unfair. But I think it was more as much my immaturity as anything. Whereas the second time it happened, I didn't agree that it should happen, but I actually understood that was their right to do it, if you like, you know. So it is a difficult, there's no doubt that it's what you're signing up for. And if you're not prepared to have those mornings where you're going to wake up and your first thought's fuck, you know, because that's what your day's going to deliver for you, well, you're in the wrong game. Mm. You're in the wrong caper. And the game will always do, it will do that. It's so, you know, it's a high performance environment where we're trying to build a system which is good enough to beat other people's systems. And, you know, we've all got our various strengths and weaknesses and idiosyncrasies and all that we bring to the game each time we front, and hope that ours is better than theirs, but it doesn't always work out. You know, all that, there's so much complexity inside it that, you know, but you have to make a call and have the conviction to do that and take a couple of deep breaths and just and go for it.
Your next part of the journey was Melbourne as CEO, and obviously a pretty big time when you joined the club as well, because amalgamation talks were well and truly with Hawthorn. Gee, that must have been an interesting time itself. And I guess, you know, obviously you had the experiences with the Save Our Sins campaign, but now a different type of challenge itself coming up.
Yeah, and it was a very different one, because what had happened is the club, Melbourne as a club, had made a decision to put itself out of existence, you know, the oldest football club in the world. And the only reason it wasn't out of existence was because the club that it chose to dance with actually their supporters didn't vote for it. Melbourne supporters voted for it. Then there were some controversies embedded in that, and it was very, it was very marginal. But what it did was it was very divisive as an issue. And also, and so the next year, so 96, the merge stuff happened. So that was a huge thing. I came in at the end of 96, and so I wasn't part of the actual conversation in regard to it. 97, we finished on the bottom. We only won four games. Neil Baum, and so I was, again, Richmond person, he finished up during that year. I was appointed CEO, went from footy manager to CEO during that period. Joe Gutnik was the president. It was a really unusual dynamic, from that perspective. But 98 went, and the end of 97, we appointed Neil Danaher coach. He did a great job. We also got a number of players back from injury. And so we actually went from last and got to a preliminary final. We probably had as good a form as anyone coming into the year. The team which was probably always going to pull us up was North Melbourne, and they did. And we got beaten in a prelim. But we beat Adelaide in the finals, and they ended up winning the premiership, ended up beating. Mm. Yeah. So I think it might be the biggest rise up the ladder at any time in the history of the game. I think that movement. And so that was great to work and to get, and I was involved with Neil Danaher's appointment. It was the first time we really went through what we call the very deep process of putting a coach together, a very comprehensive recruitment, which is still, was probably the first model of that. And he came through as the person who coached us and did a great job. And then we had a salary cap issue at the end of 98, and we also dropped away a little bit in 99, which was not sort of altogether a surprise how quickly we'd come up, and a few of those players had dropped off. So Gary Lyon came back from injury, David Schwartz, a few of those guys. And we missed the finals in 99, and I got sacked. It was just still shaking my head. It was just like, wow. I'm not sure much more we could have done. But it was sort of, we had this salary cap issue, which was mostly one which was sort of there before me. But, I take your own level of responsibility and accountability for it. But it was a really difficult period of life, I got to say, because I'd lost my dad about 3 years earlier, and he died suddenly, and then got sacked. And so I was a two-time CEO, and I was 35 at the time. Yeah. And it was a pretty miserable period of my life, and then I got the opportunity to go to Fremantle about 18 months later, and they I'm forever grateful they took an opportunity took the chance, because it wasn't without its controversy given what had actually happened at Melbourne. And then I had to sit by and watch them play off in a grand final in 2000. So it was I've got to say, it was a really challenging little period of life, that one there. And I've spoken pretty openly about some of the mental health challenges that I faced at that stage particularly. And I now look at it as probably the most defining period of my existence in so many ways, and the platform for what has been a pretty healthy life beyond that period.
Absolutely. Hey, we've only got a short amount of time left, Cameron, so I'm going to give you a couple of little quick handball questions. And I could spend all day talking to you about footy, mate. You've got a great mind. So these are sort of just really quick sort of handball ones. So do you have a favourite player that you got to work with at each of the clubs that you spent your time with? So one from Richmond, one from Melbourne, and one from Fremantle?
Yeah. Well, I had three goes at Melbourne. So the first time, Robbie Flower. Like he's the best player I saw up close. Which I know is a different conversation to the best player you've seen, but Robbie was just like, he was the single reason Melbourne people kept coming to the footy for about 15 years. An unbelievable talent, beautiful player, and a wonderful human. Lost too young in life. Melbourne had a lot of tragedy actually around, obviously Jimmy and Sean White passing as well, Dean Bailey. At Richmond, Richo, no doubt. But I got to also see Dale Waitman up close at the end of his career, but great player, and was one of my heroes as a supporter coming through. Richo, Wayne Campbell, really good player. Matthew Knight, really good player. Very underestimated AFL players. Frio, and then it's probably the second stint at Melbourne then flows into Frio a little bit, because it was Jeff Farmer, I've got to say, was like, he was one of those players you'd watch the game and would not only clap or cheer what he did, you'd laugh. It was almost like comedic how good he was. It was a Roadrunner Coyote type stuff. And he was just great person. And then obviously had him at Freo. And then Pavlic at Fremantle was just, he again, something out of the box. Just his consistency, his professionalism. He sort of epitomised sort of high performance and was a guy who, you know, as that era, that sort of mindset was really coming to the fore, was a leader in that. So I actually sat down and picked the team of all the best, and pretty crowded forward line because you've got blokes like Richo Pav, you know, David Neitz, David Schwartz, Gary Lyon was the other one. Gary Lyon, superstar. Again, the fact that Gary Lyon's not in the AFL Hall of Fame belies any sort of, mate, it's just extraordinary that he's not, you know, like he was for a period of time, him, Kernahan, probably one or two, they were the best players in the AFL, you know, and they played the state games. It was the first name they put up on the whiteboard would have been Gary Lyon. So the only trouble, do we play him centre forward or centre half back? You know, and then he got injured, and so probably his career slowed at the end. But he's sort of 19, he's 18 to 25. That's 7 years. I think he makes 5 All Australians during that time.
Yep,
like he's a superstar, and so he's absolutely great player. And I love the Viney boys. I've got to say, Todd and Jack. And then probably right at the end, right at the very end, Max Gawn. Yeah, just a pretty special.
Gawn is a ripper. One last one. If there was one CEO that you worked with during your time, who would be the one that you enjoyed having to be with and sort of having a non, I guess, work-like conversation chat with?
Probably Brian Cook. Yeah, I've got great admiration for him in terms of just the whole, what he's brought over a whole long period of time, and the fact that he's just a really genuine human who always looks out for you. He'd be that. I'd love to have a chat with my dad, I've got to say, because he was only 52 when he died, and I reckon we still had a lot of talking to do. And so I always put him on a little bit of a pedestal from that point of view. But Cookie was the guy who, and I got a huge respect for what Brendan Gale's done as a club CEO. I think it really stacks up against anyone in the history of the sport.
Cameron Schwab, thank you for joining me on the 90s Club Footy Podcast. Thank you. Appreciate you taking some time.
So I think I've taken you down a few little spots where we've been unexpected. So hopefully that's been okay for you.
That's the end of episode number 79. If you've missed any previous episodes, you can catch them all on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Amazon Music. We're on all the social media platforms, so drop us a line on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter on any particular episode you've enjoyed or a guest you would love to hear. Next week, our guest is former St Kilda ruckman, Lazar Vidovic.
It's tough, it's rugged, it's good, solid AFL football.